was an interview back with Barry Powell, who is in Michigan at the time, and I am in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Kerr Buick. And so we'll just start with kind of where you grew up. Where
you're in Columbus, Ohio?
Yes, I am.
You mean you're one of those guys from down there calling a Wolverine?
Well, I am not a Buckeye, nor do I associate with the Buckeyes.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Yeah, so where were you born and raised?
I was born in a suburb of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Oh, really? Which one?
Bellevue.
Mm-hmm.
And I was raised there and also on the north side. Because my father died when I was three, so my mother had to, you know, move. And we lived with my grandmother and two aunts for a while. And then she got her own apartment. We moved back to Bellevue, and we stayed there. And she met my father, my stepfather. And they got married, and we moved out to the North Hills area, which is north of Pittsburgh, needless to say, North Hills area.
And did you have any brothers and sisters?
No, I don't. I'm a child.
Mm-hmm. And what did your mom do?
She was a secretary.
Uh-huh. And what about your stepfather?
My stepfather worked for the Ecobol Gas Company, is a gas company in Pittsburgh at the time, which serviced gas appliances as well, delivering gas to the to your door and stuff like that. But they also had appliances like stoves, refrigerators, etc. And then after a while, he quit that, and then he and another man went into business themselves into an appliance company, actually, where they were selling and doing repairs for air conditioning, heaters, furnaces, etc., etc. Until he retired.
And would you say your childhood was average childhood? Did you have exceptional childhood, or how would you characterize?
I don't know. I guess it was an average childhood. I didn't have a father to identify with from the age of 4 to 10. I attended a Catholic school for the first 3 grades, and then when my mother got married, we moved over to the North Hills, and then I started the public school over there. And I graduated from Westview High School at the time, which now is just a little thing called a middle school, because they built a nice big high school there.
And how long, what point did you become interested in nursing or in the medical field in general?
This very circuitous route. For some reason, and I can't remember, when I was probably in the 10th or 11th grade, I decided I wanted to be a psychiatrist, believe it or not. And in our senior high school at that time, we had our senior year, our one course was divided in sociology for one semester and problems of democracy for the second semester. In our sociology course, one of the field trips we took was down to one of the Pennsylvania State Hospitals for the mentally ill, which is down by Swigley, which is another suburb of Pittsburgh. And we went down there, and we made the rounds of the hospital and saw some of the patients and some of the wards and that kind of stuff. And that furthered my interest in being a head shrink. And I graduated from high school, and I went to Penn State. The first year I was there, I really wanted to go to the University of Pennsylvania, but my mother and father couldn't afford it. So I went to Penn State. This is probably why I did this, to get back at them. Anyway, I went to Penn State, and I enrolled, head trim and all that kind of stuff. And when I was in high school, I joined a club in Pittsburgh called Forest Club of Pittsburgh, which did a lot of things like mountain climbing and things like that. But the thing that I got interested in was cave exploring, spelunking.
Mm-hmm.
And I became an avid spelunker. So when I went to Penn State, I got up to State College, and they had a grotto up there called Nittany Grotto, which was their cell of the National Speleological Society. So all I did the first year was cave explore, so I flunked. And so they told me to cool for the next year. So the next year, my sophomore year, I Steve was working the girls' dormitory, freshman's dormitory, so he just decided to do anything then. So they told me to take a leave of absence for 6 months and think it over. Well, anyhow, in the meantime, after I graduated from high school that summer before I went to Penn State, I went down to Six Mont State Hospital and I got a job as an orderly. And I did that the following year, and I did it the third year. In other words, after my sophomore year in college, and I eventually became the head of the men's violent ward, you would call it. I used to have fun. I used to work up 3-11 to unlock all these guys, you know, that are murderers and all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, remember, I wanted to be a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And I never had any problems with them, but Miss Davis, the head nurse, chief nurse then, she called me one day. She said, Barrett, she said, you've got to lock these guys up before what's his name comes on from 11 o'clock because he's scared of them. In the meantime, I met a young man there my second year there named Bill Fulton, and he was a full-time aide. Well, when I was told not to come back to college, it was 1954, and the draft was on, and there was you know, still the things in Korea going on. And I thought about, what can I do? I still want medicine, but evidently I'm not supposed to be a physician, so let's see what happens. Well, Bill, several months before, left. Bill Fulton, the guy I was telling you about, he left and went to Philadelphia and went into the Pennsylvania Hospital School of Nursing for Men, which I looked into, and it turns out that essentially two of the 3 years at that time, you spent in psychiatric nursing. I thought, well, this is a pretty good deal. So I interviewed there, and I was accepted, and I went there to Pennsylvania Hospital School of Nursing for 3 years. And I graduated. Our second year, we did go down to what was called Aiken Spruce, which is the main Pennsylvania hospital, which is actually the oldest hospital in the country, run by Dr. Benjamin Russell and Benjamin Franklin. And it's still there today. My school of nursing was closed many, many years ago, and there was a girls' school also at 8th Street, and down at Pennsylvania Hospital, and that was also closed years ago. So there's no school of nursing there anymore. So anyhow, I did that, and I thought, well, you know, I might like to go in the Army. You know, I kind of delayed it because of Korea. I mean, Korea because of going to nursing school, so I felt like that.
Sorry, that was my dog.
I owe my country some service. Like, you know, we say, should we get the draft back? Because if you don't want to be bored, you can do some service or something like that. So I felt, I had an unfortunate man, and so I went into the Army. I became a head nurse at Pennsylvania Hospital. The interesting thing was, Pennsylvania Hospital, 844, where the men's school was, where we spent our 2 years. With a private hospital, we had many people here and at the institute, like and all this kind of stuff. And so I graduated, and they asked me if I would like to work on the women's side. Now, you have to understand, this is 1957, and there was a men's side and there's a women's side. The men always worked on the men's side. The men never worked on the women's side.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we had nine other schools of nursing where they would send their students for their 3 years of psychiatric nursing. And, you know, 99% of them were women. In fact, that's how I met my wife. She's one of my students. So anyhow, the women worked on the women's side, but on the other hand, they worked on the men's side, too. Full discrimination there. So the chief of the nurse at that time asked me if I would like to go and work on the women's side. So I went over to the women's side, assistant head nurse on a, I would say, a semi-combative ward. They weren't locked up all the time, but there was a lot of trouble. And then I eventually became the head nurse. And then in May of 1958, I went into the Army, and I went to Fort Houston for my basic training. And my first assignment was Fort Eustis, Virginia. And I was hoping they'd have a psychiatric service there, but they didn't. They had a psychiatrist, but they didn't have any need for a psychiatric nurse. So I was in medical surgical nursing. And in the meantime, I was dating my two wife-to-be in Philadelphia, which is only like 300 miles away. And we eventually decided to get married when I became a first lieutenant, because instead of making $210 a month as a second lieutenant, I would be making this fabulous sum of $260 a month. And so that's what we did. We waited until I became a first lieutenant. We got married. And we lived for a few months in Williamsburg, Virginia. We got married in November of 59. We lived in Williamsburg, Virginia. And right across from Phi Beta Kappa Hall in the campus of William Mary, which I don't know if you've ever been there. It's a beautiful place. Needless to say, it's gotten too touristy in the last 20 years. Meanwhile, I had a couple of classmates and gentlemen in front of me who went into anesthesia. And this kind of intrigued me, so I said to Pat, I said, you know, in a few more months, i.e. May of 61, or 1960, I will have my 2 years in. And what do you think? Would you like to stay in the Army at least for a while, or maybe make a career of it? She said yes. She had been down to the military post here at Fort Eustis many times when she was visiting me. And the nurses were real nice. The lady nurses, they put them up in the female dorm. I was the only man there, so I just stuck with the rear badger officer's quarters. And so she got to know some of them, and she got to know some of my friends who, they were all military, and she liked it, you know. So we decided to stay in the Army.
And they said you had met her in nursing school?
Yes. She was still in nursing school. I was the head nurse on that women's course, and she was rotating through there.
Did she give any thought to joining the Army Nurse Corps as well, or did she like civilian nursing?
No, she did. In fact, when we were in Italy, the chief nurse at the time actually asked her if she'd like to join the Nurse Corps, and she said no. She was working as a civilian. She didn't want to. So anyhow, I thought, well, I got to really look into this anesthesia. We had a couple nurse anesthetists, both of them were young ladies, in our little operating room. So I went up and told them, you know, what I was thinking about. And they said, well, sure. So I spent, three or four days with them on and off, watching them anesthetize people, et cetera, et cetera. And I became quite enamored with this subject. So I went to Washington, D.C., since I was too close. I went to the Surgeon General's office, and I went and introduced myself to Colonel, I forget what her name is. I told her that I wanted to go to anesthesia school. And this was in March of 1960. And she said, well, thank you for Lieutenant Powell. You'll probably be able to get in with your credentials and grades, et cetera, et cetera. But it's going to be at least the class of a year, year and a half from now. And I said, well, that's okay. I'll stay in Fort Eustis, Virginia. Well, I got back, and 3 weeks later, I had orders to go to anesthesia school at Letterman Army Medical Center in San Francisco. So we upped and went to San Francisco, and I did my year of anesthesia there. My best friend, and actually I was the best man in their wedding, John, he also went into anesthesia school, and he went to the same place, but he went 6 months ahead of us. So there were six of us in our class. We had one lady, and we had five men. And I just saw in the ANA bulletin a couple months ago, somebody put our picture in there as some of the first men in nursing in anesthesia. I certainly wasn't the first nurse in the Army. Men had been in the Army even in the Second World War as nurses. They were non-commissioned officers. The first one was commissioned in 1956. I think when I joined, I was like, it was 150th or something that had joined nurse.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of us around. And just like the civilian counterpart of nursing and anesthesia, quite a few men go into that.
Uh-huh. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think it's probably the challenge of the scientific thing and being on a one-to-one basis with a patient. I remember somebody saying to me one time, in fact, the young lady that dropped out of our class, she said she couldn't stand patients asleep. She likes to talk to patients, and that just drove her crazy. She wasn't talking to her. And on the other hand, I felt that there was no more challenging of aspect of nursing, i.e. even medicine, except for surgery and that, but certainly in nursing, as to be able to relate on a personal, intimate basis with one individual and their family, and then take them to the operating room and give them a bunch of poison and knock them out, and if you made a mistake, you killed them, and then turn around and reverse it all.
Right.
And so when somebody says to me, you don't want to talk to patients, you don't want to rapport with patients, I really beg to differ, and I don't think that you can have a rapport much more closely than what I just described to you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So we did the first year at Letterman. At that time, the anesthesia program in the Army, just like the civilian life, had gone from 6 months to 1 year. But the Army, not to be outdone, had what was called a preceptorship, which was like another year. And so I then was transferred at the end of my first year, i.e. in 1961, to Mannequin Army Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington, where I was a preceptor, and there was another preceptor 6 months ahead of me, and we were there for a year, and there was another preceptor who came in 6 months after us, and he and his wife have turned out to be our best friends. And after the Army, we still travel back to Europe and all that kind of stuff, like going on down the Caribbean on next September. But anyhow, so I was there for a year. And the difference in the preceptorship over the actual anesthesia course, there were no classes to take or anything like that. You got the pick of the cases before anybody else because, you wanted to get more experience in this preceptorship. You presented some M&Ms and things like that that normal staff people didn't do.
Mm-hmm. And what are those? And what were those?
M&M?
Uh-huh.
Morbidity and mortality. In other words, case reviews.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Get the department together and say, today I'm going to review a case that I had yesterday with Joe Bo Kokomo, and I was taking this kid's tonsils out, and he bled and bled and bled and bled and bled. What did we do?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we didn't have any formal classes, but we did get the pick of, we got the pick of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got orders to go to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, not in a prison, but to the hospital. And there was an anesthesiologist and two nurse anesthetists, myself and a lady there. And that was nice because I had gone from two general hospitals to a very small hospital, which had very interesting patients because it was the Fort Leavenworth, if you don't know about it, is the Command and General Staff College of the United States Army. So the faculty there are well-renowned military people, and the students are also there to learn, a lot about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
From the CGNS, then you go to the War College or the National. There's several things in there. But anyhow, I stayed there for a year, and then lo and behold, I had orders to go to Italy. So I packed my wife and my young daughter, my wife who was pregnant with our second daughter, and we flew to Italy. We spent 3 wonderful years in Italy, and we still go back, like I say, with our friends. We were just back a couple years ago. We spent 3 years in Italy, and at that time, before I went to Italy, I went back to the Pentagon, and I forget exactly where it was, and I laid out what I wanted to do with my career. They said to me, Captain, what do you want to do? Write it down. So I said, well, I'd go overseas, I'd back at my bachelor's degree. Then I'd like to go to the advanced course. Then I'd like to go into anesthesia education, get my master's degree, et cetera, et cetera. I said, fine. So I didn't think anything about it. Anyhow, in Italy, the chief nurse came around. She was Irene, and that's the one that asked my wife if she wanted to be a nurse in the Army, and she said no. My nurse was, my wife was working in the OBGYN unit. Daughter there. And so I told Mildred, I said, I'd like to go back and get finish my degree, and then I'd like to go back to San Antonio. I'd like to go to San Antonio, and I would like to become, at that time, there was a course director, an assistant course director, and now the course has gone from a year to a year and a half. And then I'd like to go to the advanced course, and I'd like to get my master's degree, yak, yak, yak. I said, okay. So I had orders, and I came back, and I went to University of Nebraska, University of Omaha, Nebraska. And I got my BS in nursing, and I was there for about 6 months because I had a lot of credits from Penn State and some other credits, too, so I finished in 6 to 7 months. I went to Port Sam Houston, and I worked there for a while in the beach pavilion. There were two pavilions. There was the main hospital, and the beach pavilion was an annex. I was in another hospital by itself, which specialties were orthopedics and neurosurgery and thoracic surgery, that kind of stuff. And I'll never remember, I'll never forget, because this is now, you know, 19... this is before that. Okay. So anyhow, I went and became an assistant course director. I worked in the staff. And in 6 months, I went to the opposition advanced course, which is another way to get your ticket punched. The next one after that would be the Command and General Staff College, which I didn't go to.
Mm-hmm.
I went to that. And then I came back, and then I became the assistant course director at the nurse anesthesia course for a while. And that's when I was talking about Beach Pavilion. That then, of course, was, we're talking now, 1967, 1968, 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget Harry Gonzalez, who was representative of the United States Congress from the San Antonio area, came around to the Beach Pavilion, and you may remember I said there's several things there, like neurosurgery, thoracic surgery, and orthopedics, and he went and saw the number of orthopedic casualties we had from Vietnam. And their beds were so close together they couldn't even move, and he was just enraged by it. And we would get the guys from Vietnam, the orthopedic patients. They would be airlifted over to Hawaii, and then eventually to where they lived. You know, Denver to a hospital in Denver, San Francisco, or Walter Reed in Washington, or whatever. And of course, we got people who were in the Texas area and those states, so they would be nearest home. And we used to get called in the middle of the night and have to come out and get anesthesia because they would be airlifted from Hawaii, and some of them had very minimal care, and then we would unwrap their dressings, and the smell was just terrible because there was gangrene and all that, and we ended up doing a lot of debridement. You know what debridement is?
Mm-hmm.
The way dead skin and all that kind of stuff. So anyhow, I remember by this time I thought I had time to leave. And I was all prepared to. And I talked to the consultant surgeon general at that time. And Iris says, okay, we'll send you to Vietnam. She says, no, I don't want you to go to Vietnam. She says, I want you to go get your master's degree. And I said, oh, okay.
And so you had volunteered and said, I want to go. And
I said, it's time for me to go. All my buddies are going, and they're asking me, who do I know that I don't go? Because some of them have been over there twice. And I got orders. I put in for three schools, Boston College, University of Pittsburgh, and I forget what else, and I decided to, since I was in Pittsburgh, to go back to the University of Pittsburgh. So I went back there from April of 69 to May of 71, about 26 months or something, and I got my master's in nursing. Then after that, I went to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think about the war at that point?
About the war at that point?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I really didn't think anything about it. I knew we were in a war, and I was hoping we would get out of it because so many people were getting killed. I guess at that time I still had so much feeling of national service in that I just didn't question why we were there,
mm-hmm.
how we ended up, which would be different nowadays if I was going to go to Iraq. But anyhow, I went over, and I went to the 67th back in Hubei, which is north of Da Nang, over the Hai Nam Pass, if you know where that is, in South Wei, the old capital city. And I spent 6 months there, and you have to remember now, this is 71, and things are winding down over there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't have the casualties like John, my classmate, you know, he was at that place, not Place in My Lie or whatever, not My Lie, where, you know, they went like 96 hours without sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
Big runovers they had by Quezon. By Quezon. We didn't have any. At the most casualties I got at one time was like 8 or 9.
Uh-huh.
And the most memorable two things that happened over there was this young gentleman got flown in by helicopter because we were right beside the airfield. And there was the medevac stations right there. So they flew this GI, and he was like 22 years old. And I got called to the emergency room. And he had been shot by one of his own men. He was out on the perimeter on guard. Somebody came up and shot him with an M15. We don't know why. And so we were needed to resuscitate him because he was bleeding. And we put 4 large bore IVs in him, one in each arm, one in each leg. And I'll never forget, you know, talking to the man. And I said to him, son, you know, I have to put a breathing tube down in your throat to breathe for you. And I can't give you an anesthetic because if I do, it's not going to be good for you. He said, okay, sir. So he opened his mouth. And I put the tube in. And then I, you know, talked to him then. But finally, the surgeon opened his chest. And by this time, you know, he really didn't know what was going on, though he was still alive. And then we found that the subclavian artery on the left-hand side had been hit, so all the blood we were putting was just bleeding out from there. And we got up to 75 units of blood, and he just didn't make it. The other thing at that time, too, was I was over there when fragging was going on, though we didn't have anybody fragged. You know what I mean by fragging?
Yeah,
okay. We didn't get anybody fragged in our area. We got a couple from, we were there supporting one of the brigades of the 82nd Airborne at Camp Hoffman down the road. But the other thing was, at this time now, we had the heroin and cocaine stuff, which was being smuggled in, I guess, by the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. And I would get called to the emergency room at least once a week to resuscitate somebody, you know, that had OD'd.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is you never know who would be there, because one day I went over there and I resuscitated this guy, and it was one of the guys, one of the OR techs that I worked with in the daytime. And he had OD'd, and he actually died because we couldn't resuscitate him. Then I came home from Christmas, and things at that place were kind of quiet. And I came home from Christmas, and when I came back, I went up to play coup for my last 6 months up in the Central Highlands, which is a very nice area. And again, not much going on. A little more frightful than Fubai, because the hospital at Plei Khu sat above the airfield, and then further up the mountain were a couple of microwave antennae. These are huge things, like 50 by 60 feet, which would take the microwaves coming from, like, Fubai, where I was, in the northern part of southern South Vietnam, up to Plei Khu, and then microwave messages and stuff down to Saigon. And when I got there, the American support troops had pulled out because the war was really winding down. And they used to have a battery of 105s up there, and people tell me when Charlie shot his rockets off, why, from the Eshaw Valley, why, you know, we'd open up in two or three rounds and they'd stop. Well, is Charlie went out there in the Eshaw Valley. That's the one that's over towards Cambodia. And he shoot those 122 rockets, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If you know what those were, they were very inaccurate. They set them up in a tree, you know, the launch thing up against a tree and all that kind of stuff was just kind of aim and shoot. And what they aimed for, of course, was the microwave antenna because they were so big. And they figured if they shoot right over that, about 6 feet, the thing's going to land on the airfield. Well, every once in a while, they landed in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. And is this, which hospital is this in Pleiku? Is this the 71st?
I forget what the name of it was. The other one's the 67th. I forget what the one in Pleiku was called.
Mm-hmm. I know the 71st evac, but I think there was another smaller one in Pleiku or near Pleiku as well.
It was in a back hospital. I can't remember. But anyhow, so we every once in a while have rockets going over and that, but kind of, still, there was two anesthetists there, too. At the other place, there was actually an anesthesiologist, junior anesthetist, and the anesthesiologist left, and there was a gal and myself there, and then when I went up to play coup, they had already pulled the anesthesiologist, and it was just Ed Lauer and I. He was the other nurse anesthetist, so it was just the two of us. And then I got a stuff drop 3 weeks before my bureau, in other words, day of separation from Vietnam, I got 3 weeks earlier. And when I did, they actually were evacuating on my plane, a C-150 or C-1, whatever it was. They were evacuating some of the civilians that had been friendly with the Americans because the next town up the road was Khartoum, and Charlie was saying he was going to come down there again and overrun the Pleiku. So there were a lot of people in there with me that understand. With the next day, all the female personnel from the hospital were evacuated. And then I guess a few days later, the hospital was actually closed down, and everybody moved down to Quezon or something. And they reopened the hospital, I guess, a month or so later because Charlie never came, but they never sent any women back there. It was just men and that. It was interesting because when we were up there, as I said, there were no Americans around, so we used to go over to the garbage dump and shoot the 7mm recoilless rifles and machine guns in it so we would protect ourselves because we were told if Charlie comes down, we, i.e. the staff of that hospital, were going to have to protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But that was fun, so we went out and did a lot of shooting.
And was that just the men or did the women go too?
The women didn't go.
Mm-hmm. Was that policy or was that just kind of what happened?
I don't think any of them wanted to. I don't think there was any policy that they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
I think one did go, to come to think about it. I think one did go. But most of them, yeah, they have not had the guns and stuff like that. So.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Luckily, that never happened, and then I came back.
And what was your rank by this point? You'd been in the Army for quite a while.
I made major when I was in at the University of Nebraska. I made major. When I left Vietnam in 1971, I was promotable to lieutenant colonel.
Mm-hmm. So you ranked higher than most of the nurses who were on staff at that time, right?
I was the ranking person. But remember, in Pleiku, there were only about 8 or 10 nurses. It wasn't like a big, big hospital.
Uh-huh.
Even at the other hospital in Phu Bai, I think there were only like 10 or 15 of us. And I was a major, and the chief nurse there, John Garland, he was a lieutenant colonel, and then he eventually came. He came back, and then he became a colonel, and he retired before I did.
Mm-hmm.
So then I came back, and I went back to Manigan Army Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington. I became the assistant. I was supposed to take over the anesthesia program. Now, by now, the anesthesia program had changed. If you remember, I said it started out in 6 months, then a year, then a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, all this is going on. They opened what they call a Phase 1 and a Phase 2 program at William Beaumont Hospital in El Paso. They opened what was called the Phase 1. So all that are the anesthesia students would go to William Beaumont for 6 months. And they'd have the majority of their didactic work there,
mm-hmm.
with very little clinical experience. now 2 years. Then for the next year and a half, they would go to other places for their phase two. They go to Letterman in San Francisco. They would go to Madigan. They'd go to the one in Denver. I forget the name of it. Of course, they would stay also in El Paso. And they would also go to Walter Reed for their second massage. I was up there to take over as the course director of phase two. But Frank Mazyarski, who is there, and Frank is now the president-elect of the ANA, and so he's been around a while too, and he retired from the military when I was in Tacoma. And Frank was going to go to the University of Washington to get his PhD, but something happened and he got delayed. So they couldn't put me in his place, so they made me the assistant chief of the department, which was fine for a year. And then Frank went on up to the University of Washington, started a doctorate, but he didn't finish it. And then I took over the program of nurse anesthesia until maybe 1973 to 1976. And got orders. The anesthesia consultant at that time was a man, and he came up and I told him, I kind of wanted to stay there and retire to Tacoma because we liked it so well. Well, no sooner had he gone back home than I got orders to go to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And so I called one of the brass in Washington, who I know, Pat Miller. And I said, Pat, this is a waste of time for me, who's been in education now for a total of about 6 years, to send me to Fort Sill to be a chief nurse anesthetist. And she said, oh, okay, we'll see what we can do. And I got orders to go to Fort Sam Houston, back to San Antonio again. And this time I became the chief of the phase one of the anesthesia program. And what they were going to do was move the phase one from William Beaumont to the academy, because all the courses are at the academy. The basic courses for officers and enlisted, the advanced courses, et cetera, et cetera. So they wanted it under one roof. So I rewrote the POI, Program of Instruction, updated it, you know, what we were going to teach. And another gentleman, Joe Rando, came over from Beaumont. And we opened the first course there. And while I was there, I went to Hawaii to see about opening a phase two over there, which we did. And I went to Fort Benning, Georgia Hospital to see about opening a phase two there, which we did. So we had more phase twos, which meant we could take larger classes. And I think our first class had like 45 students. And again, with phase one, they took all their science courses, physical assessment, and things like that. Did very little in the operating room. And there was at that time then the possibility of pushing for a master's degree for the program.
Mm-hmm.
And we were looking at the University of Texas, and I was talking to my compatriot at the nurse anesthesia program at the Air Force over at Randolph Air Force Base, and he agreed with me, and he said, you know, this is kind of silly duplicating. Here's two separate courses, Air Force, Army, you know, within 10 miles of each other. And what we ought to do is get both these together for phase one and also use it for phase two and see about getting a master's program and all that kind of stuff. So we were working on it, and I had my second class. And then, in the meantime, I had been, for several years, on-site visitor and a senior on-site visitor for the Council on Accreditation of Nurse Anesthesia. Do you know what that is?
I've heard of the organization, but
that's the one that does the accreditation for your program. And at that time, gave you 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years, or probation, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now they go. I think now as long as 10 years or something. But you would go out to hospitals, and you would be a reviewer, and then eventually you became a senior reviewer. And if the program deemed it by location or notoriety or whatever, you'd also have an anesthesiologist go with you.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I had put in for my doctoral degree at the University of Texas two times to the Army, and they turned me down. And well, by then I had 18 years in, you know, and I'm saying, well, you know, this is silly, because if I go get my doctorate in 2 years, that's going to be 2 years for that, and I own two for one, so I'll be in for another 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they did, they sent another guy who happened to be in my nursing class at the University of Pittsburgh, Joe Maloney, and they sent him. Now, Joe was a good-looking boy, knew how to flick his eyes at the gal, though. And I know what his grade average was, and my grade average was, in the University of Pittsburgh. And I was invited to join Sigma Theta Tau, which is the National Honor Society of Nursing. And he wasn't, that's all I'm saying. So he knows stuff like that. So he got selected the first year. In the second year, they selected Lieutenant Halliburton, who was a gal who was in with the girls. And she got selected to go, and they prepared her, and she eventually came and took over the phase one when I left. And I understand she lasted about a year, and she had her breakdown, which anybody could have told, but anyhow, that's beside the point. So anyhow, I'm getting turned down for the doctoral program, and I know I'm going to have to leave, and I'm thinking what's going on, and I got a call from the council to come up to the interview to review the program under anesthesia at the University of Michigan. And, not the University of Michigan, Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia. And since the head of anesthesia there, Dr. Jacoby, was well known throughout the country, they decided to send an anesthesiologist, Tom Cornfield, who was from the University of Michigan. And then I had an assistant, and we went and, you know, we did it, and the program really had to close and everything. And of course, I had to very graciously front Dr.
Sorry.
Front Dr. Jacoby in a very nice way that, you know, this program really needed to close it. So I did that, and afterwards, Tom said, I really am impressed in the way that you handled it. Thank you. And it was a couple weeks later, I got a phone call from him. He said, the head of the program up here has been dismissed. He was caught with a couple of the students, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And would you be interested in coming up? Because the assistant doesn't want to stay. She was going to, but she decided not to, and review the job. So I flew up. My wife came and reviewed the place and the program, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's, it came out the second time that, and eventually I called Washington. I talked to my friend Pat Miller, who I talked to before, and I said, Pat, I wanted you to know that I am going to retire in May, accepting a job at the University of Pittsburgh. I had told him before that I was looking a few months before.
Mm-hmm.
I first got contact. That's, I have to be honest with you, I've been contacted, you know, I'm looking for possible educational positions.
Mm-hmm.
And Pat said, well, Barry, said, you know, you don't know what we have planned for you. And I said, well, I know I don't know, because nobody responded to the little, you know, hint that I was looking. And she says, well, we are planning to move you to Washington to be the chief at Walter Reed and hope to the Surgeon General for nurse anesthesia. And I said, well, thank you very much. And I said, I realize it's the number one job in nurse anesthesia in the Army, but I really want to stay in education. Though I was in education there, but I would still be in administration. There was a director of phase two there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd be mainly administrative. And then also being the consultant to the Surgeon General means that you have to be responsible for moving to nurse anesthetist to different assignments, and then, you know, getting a call saying, well, I can't stay here, I got to go near home because my mother's dying or this is going on. Then you move that person, and you have to move somebody to fill that person, you know what I mean?
Right.
And all that kind of stuff. People want special things in that. So I decided that I would go ahead and retire and come up to the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And so yet I was getting kind of sort of had like a 3.9 average. So I took my exam for my PhD. Preparing my to do my dissertation, I had my dissertation appointment committee assembled. I had one meeting with them. I was going to do a dissertation on the efficacy of the education of the people that make the on-site dissertations for the Council on Accreditation. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, the chief of anesthesiology left, and the guy that I met who was with me on that site visit to Jefferson, here it turns out he was vehemently anti-nurse anesthetist, but he needed somebody in there to take over the school until they could close it. In fact, he told Dr. Cohen, several years later, this is the opportune time to close this program. You know, Peter said, no, he said, I've made a commitment to Barry Powell, I'm not going to do that. So, be as it may, they started that stuff in about 1984 and 85. They went before the Board of Regents, you know, and they were doing things like, you know, the anesthesiologists have to go to the nursing anesthesia program to run by how their lecture that they're going to give to the residents and all this kind of crap, you know, and I got so upset about it, and I thought, damn. And I was working with the School of Nursing to set up a master's degree at the School of Nursing, and I realized that got torpedoed through the back door. And I had, in the meantime, I had set up an optional program, an optional master's program, which a couple of my students took through the School of Education. Actually, it was my predecessor that set it up. And so I wanted to set one up in the School of Nursing. Well, little do they know now how many programs of nursing anesthesia are in schools of nursing. So, anyhow, that got shot down, and I said, the heck with this, you know, talk about that, and I'm taking these courses down here for the doctoral thing, and these education professors are working 6-7 hours a week, and are out doing their own business and all that kind of crap, and the courses they're teaching, I didn't know about, and I got 3.9, and my students are busting their asses off, and they're telling me, oh, they go there and do this, you know, do to the students, so they for their... So I said, the hell with this, the hell with the universe. So I didn't finish my PhD. And the program, which I guess I regret, the program then was closed in 1986. And then I was fortunate because I had the only nurse that I know of. I had a faculty appointment in the School of Medicine. And I was in there long enough. I was in for 7 years and more. Nothing happened, and therefore I got tenure.
Oh, well.
So they couldn't fire me.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted my position. And I'm sure if I had got my PhD, you know, I would have gone on to be an associate professor or so. Maybe not, but probably so. But anyhow, so I stayed there, and I retired in 1998. And then I went back. I phased out over a couple of years. I went to 80% and 60% and 50%, where I was working like, you know, 1 week on, 1 week off, or 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. And then I retired, and I went back and worked on and off for a couple of years, helping them out here and there, usually in the ophthalmology building or in our surgery center of Livonia, which is about 15 miles from the hospital. And we were with our friends I was telling you about that we met at Madigan originally, that we traveled around. Jim went on to finish. I was promotable to full 06, but I gave that up full colonel when I got out, and he went on and became a colonel. He got out. He was, and he still is, the chief anesthetist at Sunset in Hollywood, California.
Mm-hmm.
That big, oh, you know, not having a TIA. That big hospital out there, that whole we were over in May of 1991. The forests were over in France, and then we were going down to Spain, and then we were going to go back to Italy. We had been there for a couple of years. And in Spain, I decided to have a stroke. And so our vacation was cut short when we went back and spent an extra week in Paris and flew back. So needless to say, after that, I didn't work again, so I hadn't been working since.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very fortunate. That was the day we were going to leave to go to Barcelona and take an overnight train to Milano.
Mm-hmm.
I got up and went to the bathroom, went back to sleep, and I woke up and I said, "What? I'm having a stroke." And so they called the ambulance, and people say to me, "Well, gee, what was it like having a stroke like that in Spain?" And I said, "Well, they did everything right. They came and got me Pat in the meantime to give me some aspirin. I had been on Plavix, and the doctor in the ambulance said, you should have given him the aspirin. You might have killed him if it was a bleed. My hypertension guy said, probably saved my life."
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, I went to the hospital. I was completely paralyzed on the right side. I had expressive aphasia. Expressive aphasia, you know what you want to say, but control it and flow on, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And they did the right thing. They took a CAT scan on me. They gave me medicine. They didn't give me the TPA, and which some people say you should have within 4 hours, because in Europe they feel that that's not completely, really set in concrete that that should be done.
Mm-hmm.
And then they took another CAT scan 48 hours later, and sure enough, there was a lesion there in my cerebral artery on my left side. In the meantime, my expressive aphasia went, my paralysis in my left leg went, and I just had kind of a drooping arm, which I came back and told PT for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, except I can't write, but other than that, I can vision. So I really can't. I couldn't start an IV either. That's kind of a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. And so what have you been doing since then? Just family things, or are you still active in different organizations?
Yeah, I'm active in my church. Christ, I usually go over and print the bulletin and relieve one of the secretaries if they want a day off or something comes up. They have to have a doctor's appointment or something like that. And I help out with vacation Bible school.
Uh-huh.
The rest of the time, I spend a lot of time on the internet. And we need to say, travel. We do a lot of traveling.
Uh-huh.
I'm still working. She has a nice job. And I don't know if I want her to quit because I'm, she's kind of just keeping me at the level of living that I'm getting accustomed to. She is a interestingly, Pat never went and got her degree. She's a 3-year degree graduate.
Uh-huh.
And she's at the University of Michigan. She's the nurse manager of the Clinical Research Center. The Clinical Research Center is about 75 of them in the country, and they're medical centers, and they're completely funded by the NIH. In fact, they're going through their renewal. They renew every 4 years. And their last time was like $35 million. And they even rent the space in the university. They pay the university the money to pay the salaries and all that kind of stuff. And so she has a very responsible and prestigious job when you consider that down there all the head nurses have master's degrees.
Yeah.
So anyhow, that's it. So we travel around and...
Well, I've written down some notes of things that you mentioned that I wanted to go back over a little bit more too. I didn't want to interrupt your narrative as you were going along. You mentioned that your nursing school was an all-male nursing school. Is that right?
Yeah, there were two divisions. There was the girls.
Mm-hmm.
They were down at 8th Street.
Uh-huh.
And they did their med-surg nursing down there for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And for 3 months they did their pediatrics at St. Christopher's. St. Christopher's Children's Hospital, Philadelphia, CHOP. The men would go down there their second year, and we would get our med-surg, certainly not as much as they did.
Uh-huh.
they in turn would come out to our place for 3 months of psychiatric nursing.
Mm-hmm. So it was set up that the men and women had more emphasis on different aspects of nursing.
Right.
By the school.
It was definitely psychiatric, and the women's was medical surgical.
That's interesting.
Now, we were the first class of men. Now, the men's school was founded in 1927 by Leroy Craig. He was still alive when I went there. We were the first class of men to do two things. One, start a pediatric affiliation. They had never been done before because it wasn't a requirement in the Pennsylvania State Nurses, you know, the Board of Nursing exam.
Mm-hmm.
That became a requirement when I was in nursing school. Secondly, another requirement came that you needed to have experience in OB-GYN, OB.
Uh-huh.
OB was only like 10 hours or something like that. So we were the first ones to go. We didn't go to Children's Hospital, Pennsylvania. We went to St. Christopher's, another hospital in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
And did our 3 months of pediatric. And then when we were at 8th Street, across the street there was Women's Hospital of Pennsylvania, which is right across the street from Pennsylvania Hospital. And we were the first men to be in, quote, OB.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all this was something, these guys coming in here, all this kind of stuff, and what we were allowed to do. We were allowed to be in the labor room, you know, that was all. We didn't go in and assist with deliveries or see deliveries or anything like that, which, of course, now has completely changed.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, that was the first.
How were you received when you went to Pete's and then to OB?
Fine.
Mm-hmm.
The women nurses didn't have a problem with it, and the patients didn't have any problems with it.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little surprised, but, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There, the doctors, majority of them were men, so I guess it really didn't make any difference to them.
Uh-huh.
Again, we weren't doing anything. We were taking fetal heart sounds, you know, vital signs, and that was it. This was before they went into the delivery room.
And did you face, or did your class as a whole face stigma because you were male nurses, or did you find that people had certain stereotypes about male nurses, or did you?
Oh yeah, there were things about that. Of course, in having nine different schools of nursing rotating out to our place for psychiatric nursing. There were nine schools there, Chestnut Hill University of Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania Hospital, and several other ones that I don't think any of them had any men in that time. Since then they have, of course. And I guess, you know, having rotated out there, they got to know us and found out that, you know, we were just like any other guy. In fact, I would wager 95% of the guys at my hospital out here at 44th Street married women that they met on affiliation. People, you know, if you talk to somebody who wasn't familiar with medicine, you know, what are you doing, my nurse? Well, what do you mean you're a nurse? What do you do? Oh yeah, okay.
Uh-huh.
And I remember one time, somebody either asked me or my wife, in all seriousness, when we went up to Madigan after we were Letterman, we went up to Madigan for our second year, and you know, different people were wondering about, you know, what the nurses were, though they had heard, and they really hadn't seen any. They asked me, or they asked my wife, well, now, do you have a capping ceremony? Will you get a cap?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a capping ceremony. We don't have a capping ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I know a couple of the G1 guys, his wife was kind of funny, and then it turned out, she turned out to be a nice friend, and the officers club up there, my wife got elected as vice president, so I guess it was acceptable. You know, you hear these things, and of course you yourself run into, I had several guys in the Army that I worked with that turned out to be homosexual and all that kind of stuff, and of course, you know, gave the rest of us a bad name, and I guess today it might not be bad, I don't know, but, I know one, you know, asked to leave the Army, and he went out to the airport and solicited other men out of the airport, which he did it on purpose so he would get discharged.
Mm-hmm.
So it was always that, you know, that people America.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in the Army it became more acceptable. And so there's still not that many men that go into nursing, like I think down here at the University of Michigan. We have, maybe there's three or four in the nursing school. We have several nurses, men that work in the hospital. In fact, my urologist who takes care of me because of my stroke, she runs the stroke clinic when I first met her in 91. Her husband was actually getting his master's degree in nursing from the University of Michigan. And I said, aha, it's reverse time now. My mother, I think, was disappointed.
Uh-huh.
I went to a really important nurse and all that kind of stuff. And then, as I got more education and all that kind of stuff, she would say to people, well, you know, he's just not a nurse now. He's an anesthetist. He's teaching the people to teach the people and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
But I really never let it bother me.
Uh-huh. And you think that's changed now?
Right.
You think that perception has changed now?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Though I still feel that there is still a feeling of somewhat of homosexuality with men in nursing.
Mm-hmm.
I know some of them went down here at the University of Michigan, you know, or on that. But they're accepted, I think, for who they are and what they are.
Uh-huh.
Nurses, and I don't think they're discriminated against. I can't honestly say that I was ever discriminated against in any way because of being a nurse. And I don't think they're discriminated against. I can't honestly say that I was ever discriminated against in any way because of being a nurse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the Army treated male nurses and female nurses the same or any differently? I mean, were you given different assignments?
I think that a good example is when I had put in for my doctorate, and they sent Joe Maloney, okay, so he was a man, but then when I put in, they sent Sarah. I definitely think that was because she was, quote, one of the girls.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of female nurses, I think probably, I don't know how much more, if any more than that, were certainly homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a group, you know, that if you knew, you know, you got promoted quicker, or you got things like this and things like that, and I think she was that way. And I'm just not saying that because of bitterness. I've heard other people say it too, so.
Uh-huh.
But other than that, one thing, and I guess it wasn't a big thing, I don't feel I was discriminated against by the nurse corps at all. In fact, many of the women in the nurse corps, in fact, women are responsible for where I got to.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they were sitting on the promotion boards. They were sitting on the school selection boards until some of us got up to be colonels and lieutenant colonels when we started doing that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly can't complain, you know. I got my anesthesia training for 2 years, my undergraduate and my graduate degree in the Army, all expenses paid. So,
all
that discrimination.
And you said that the one nurse that was sent to the doctor program, he said that she was a homosexual, and that maybe there were some female nurses who were homosexuals. Was that a common perception of the female nurses, or do you think it was somewhere a reflection of a reality? Or
I think it was a reflection of reality. I mean, you could talk to people, other women, and they would say, oh, yeah, she, you know, she sleeps with so-and-so, or she has that and all that kind of stuff, just like, you know, some of the guys would sleep together and then. And, you know, and I think, well, maybe it was I that was just bitter, was it sour grapes that I did get sent, and particularly after a year or so that this lady, mentioned her name, so please don't say anything.
No. I'm just curious about general perception.
She does. And she was a very nice person, don't get me wrong. I liked her very much. We were friends.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I had more experience than that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, you know, why? She wasn't exceptionally a star or anything like that. She was like the rest of us. I just came up through the ranks.
And you said, too, that you had joined the Army voluntarily and that you had feeling the national service and that sort of thing. Had people in your family been in the military? Did you grow up around that?
Oh, yes. My great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was a Denison, and he was over here, the Denisons were here in 16 or 18, but I had a great-great-whatever-grandfather who was in the Revolutionary War, so now my daughters can become daughters of American Revolution. I can become a son of American Revolution, and I never did that. So we had that, and we had some throughout the years, we had the military. There were some in the Civil War. I don't remember. I have all my stuff downstairs. I had my Uncle Jimmy was an Air Force pilot, a fighter pilot in the First World War. My Uncle Denny, who's still alive, was a bombardier in the Second World War. In fact, he was a bombardier that led the Schweinfurt Raid, if you know what the Schweinfurt Raid was. There's ball bearing plants in that, and he's still alive, too. And then me, and of course my stepfather. Not every generation, but the majority of generations since the Revolutionary War have been in service of one kind or another.
And what had your stepfather done in the military?
He was in the Air Force.
Oh, okay, in the Air Force. And did he talk about it a lot, or, I mean, did you kind of hear stories growing up, or?
He had gotten out, and he met my mother, he waited until he got out, and told me some of it. He worked on the Norden bomb site, which was the bomb site that they put in the bombers in the Second World War, which is really a breakthrough as far as being able to pinpoint where you're dropping bombs. He worked in there, and then he was put on a boat, and he was on his way to Tinian Isle, which he got to. And Tinian's also in the same Saipan was. In fact, on his way to Tinian, the two atomic bombs were dropped in the war with Japan. So when he got over there, the war was over, and he spent a few months there, and he came back and was discharged.
Uh-huh. And so when you signed up for the Army, what do you think were your big motivational factors?
The draft was still on, I figured, well, they're going to get me, one way or the other. I mean, the Korean War was over, and they're going to get me anyhow, so why don't I might as well just go in, and, maybe I can request to be stationed near home or something like that, which is kind of what happened. I was in Philadelphia, but I got stationed in Virginia, so...
And you signed up directly into the Army Nurse Corps. And I guess when you signed up, you were second lieutenant first. And so how did you relate more to the doctors that you worked with, other nurses, enlisted men? Who did you, I guess, hang out with or socialize with?
I know. In those days, you were an officer, and enlisted men were a little different than that. But I used to work night duty, so I became friends with the sergeant and that. But, we really didn't hang out with each other. And there was a nurse there, a major, who really was my mentor. She was really, really good. She showed me the ropes, of med-surg nurse in the Army and the whole thing, what you do. She broke me in, other words, how to do stuff. And with her encouragement, I actually went into anesthesia school. I started working nights because I was dating my wife in Philadelphia. And so I'd work 10 days on, I'd have 4 days off. So either every time I had 4 days off, or at least every other time I had 4 days off, I was driving up to Philadelphia, or she was coming down. And so my time... was working until the morning and going to the mess hall and having breakfast with a bunch of the guys, enlisted guys, and then going back to the hooch and going to sleep for about 8 or 9 hours. And in the evening going over to the officers club and just, bumping around over there with some friends.
And was that the same in Vietnam as well?
Yeah, in Vietnam, they had an officer's club over there, but it was also officer NCO. And so you had a mixture of the officers with the non-commissioned officers. So.
Mm-hmm.
And in Vietnam, too, because of the situation being a combat situation, it was you were just a little more close and more friendly with everybody, whether they were enlisted or the CO of the hospital or whatever. You know, it was a camaraderie, a unit, you know, cohesiveness, if you want to say, you know, we were there to do a job and let's do it. And of course, the, you know, the cocaine and heroin crap started.
Mm-hmm. And was that a big problem? You mentioned the one OR tattoo OD'd. Was drug use a problem among the medical staff as well?
He was the only one that OD'd that I know of. I think there were some others who were shooting up, but they never got caught.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the ones that we were working on were the combat, the combat soldiers.
Mm-hmm. How was morale among the medical staff in Vietnam?
We all wanted to get it over and get home.
Mm-hmm.
But we all stuck with each other and learned to, as you went over there, and I went in, Fred Blacksmith, he and I are still friends, he was the nurse over there, and Teresa, I don't know, she was the other nurse in Essex, and I came in, and, he got broken, and, they left, and somebody else came, and as people came, you break the new ones in and say goodbye to the old ones. But it was always a unit. We had a good CO, and we were there to support the 82nd Airborne, and of course, not only that, they're supporting troops in that, too, because they the guys down there putting the rocket on, into the rocket mount on the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And he stood in front of it, and the thing went off. You don't stand in front of the rocket launcher when you're loading it.
Right.
It went right through him.
Mm-hmm.
Made a nice hole, and it took his liver and everything. Of course, by the time he got over to us, he was dead.
And you said you signed up and volunteered to go to Vietnam, and then they sent you to get your master's and then sent you to Vietnam, right?
Right.
And was it just kind of expected that you did a war tour if there was a war on? Once you were, career officer, was that sort of expected?
John, my friend, talking about going to nursing school together, he was in Korea and Vietnam. I know some guys that were in Korea twice in Vietnam. I know some guys, nurses, that were in Vietnam twice.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky I didn't get to go to Korea. I just went to Vietnam once. I went to Italy. John spent 5 years in Germany, and Jim, my friends that we travel with, they spent 3 years in Germany. So.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you would have been sent even if you hadn't volunteered?
I'm sorry?
Do you think you would have been sent anyway if you hadn't volunteered?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Just they wanted me to go get my master's degree first.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And were there any kind of discipline problems or issues that you had to deal with? Once you were in Vietnam, you said you outranked most people that you worked with. Did you sort of get stuck with dealing with those issues? Or?
Really? With the lieutenant colonel, we just didn't have disciplinary things where people were doing stuff, that you had to tell them to knock it off, except for the drug stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I was getting the deep stuff like that. Operating room, and you're going to do something, you're going to kill somebody or something like that, but there was nothing that we had to lock anybody up or give them a court martial, at least nothing in my mind.
Uh-huh.
I'm not saying this didn't happen, but I was not involved with it or
And did your views of the war change at all because of your tour or while you were there?
Towards the end, they just kind of got senseless, and then there was some really funny. I met a general way. He came into, he was the one that became the prime minister. shorts, a very flamboyant man. He was up in Pleiku. He had a nephew graduating from the Vietnam Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
Up there for his graduation. And lo and behold, the poor guy crashed.
Mm-hmm.
Brought him to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Over there, or? Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I actually enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, remember I told you we didn't have the massive casualties that
right.
other people saw. So I really didn't see a bitterly contested war with a lot of casualties.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have issues with nightmares or flashbacks or any of that when you came home?
No. What's interesting was that when I came home, my wife, we had left Pittsburgh. We were in Pittsburgh for my master's degree, and we were near my parents, so Pat said she'd like to go near her mother when I went to Vietnam, so I moved them down to Florida. And in Pleiku, once in a while, you'd hear some rockets. Not like you would go by, you'd hear rockets. Going on, offers to see them going overhead, not quite like Pleiku, where you can stand out there and watch them going over the microwave screens. And we all had beds, or I had a bed, I had a piece of plywood on the top of it, so anytime anything got pretty hot, I'd just, get under there with a little protection. It was the same thing in Pleiku. We'd get under the bed, but anyhow, I went home for Christmas time. And I didn't tell Pat I was going to get there. And we got out early, and we flew from Dubai. We flew down by helicopter to Saigon. Then Air Vietnam from Saigon to Hong Kong. Then Hong Kong to Tokyo. Then Tokyo to Los Angeles. And Los Angeles to Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been up for something like 60 hours. And I thought, I don't know what my wife was surprised. So I said, well, why don't you go to bed, I'll lay down with you for a few minutes to go to sleep, because I was just exhausted. So I lay down, I fell asleep. Well, down there, Christmas time, they shoot firecrackers. So the firecrackers are off, and I'm under the bed, and Pat comes in, she says, what are you doing under the bed?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I thought I was in bed. Oh, I said, that's second nature. When you hear this stuff, you get under the bed.
All right.
That's the only thing I've had. I've never had any flashbacks. I've had a couple of dreams, but they were about people, and that really wasn't about the war itself.
Right.
So I was very fortunate there.
Uh-huh.
We had a nice little club there, so we'd go over and drink. So it's a drink. I didn't get drunk in that, but we'd go over every night and drink. And we had a cook who was a real good born officer. He also ran the kitchen over at the officer's club. And so we'd go out there a lot of times for dinner and that. And of course, we knew a lot of the Vietnamese people that worked for us, particularly the women who would do cleaning up and all that kind of stuff. I never had them fear or anything like that, but they were nice people. And we had learned that after we left Dubai, that I guess a year, I don't know what it was, and how, whenever Saigon, when we left Saigon, and the Vietnamese took over, and that we understand that they went to a lot of these places, including that hospital, and we were told that many of the people, that particularly the women that did a lot of menial labor, that were shot because they were collaborating with the Americans. Now, I don't know particularly if a certain one was, but we heard that.
Mm-hmm. I've never heard anybody else say that, that they got to go back to the States.
We had leave. We still had 30 days of leave or something every year, even though we were over there.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't care where you went. Most of the people went to Australia for R&R.
Mm-hmm.
Or they went to Hawaii. Or New Zealand, and that. I decided for R&R, I want to go back and see my wife.
Right.
If I could get back, I'd get back, and you know, I did. As I said, you know, I hopped around, you know, Major and I, and he was the executive officer, and we hopped around and went back. So I ended up about I guess I had a whole 6 days at home,
mm-hmm.
and then 2 weeks in Australia.
That's interesting. Just a couple more things then, and I'll let you go. We've been talking for a long time now. The memorial that went in D.C., what did you think about that?
I thought it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Not necessarily the wall, but the statue of the women, and you know, sometimes it's called the Women's Memorial, sometimes it's called the Nurses Memorial.
There's a memorial there for the women who were there attending to some GI.
All right.
Which I thought was very, very nice.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the women I knew in the Army actually was one of the ones responsible for getting that memorial done.
Mm-hmm.
Collecting money and, you know, getting people to vote, et cetera, et cetera. She spent several years doing that.
All right. And which one was that?
That was the women.
Uh-huh.
Women there for the women nurses. I'm not sure which, but it shows some nurses there.
Right.
You know, taking care of some GIs.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I meant which of the women that were in charge of that did you know?
Oh, I don't remember her name.
Uh-huh.
She was a nurse.
Uh-huh.
Nurse. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And a colonel. She retired.
Okay.
We were stationed together. I think. When I was in Madigan the second time, or at Crook the second time, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
She was very active in that.
Mm-hmm. And so you thought that the memorial was a nice memorial. Was there any talk among any of the male nurses that all of these people in the statue are women?
Gosh, I don't think so.
Uh-huh.
I didn't think anything particularly about it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I thought it was probably overdue.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And do you read much that's been written by any of the nurses?
No, I haven't seen anything, actually. Nothing on the Vietnam Wall, to get back to that.
Uh-huh.
Very nice.
Uh-huh.
That one made me cry.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the nurses that I served with in Italy, Brian's last name, she was a very interesting individual. She was a major. And she was one of the, I think there were 10 nurses on the Tan Death March.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
She would never talk about it very much. Hattie Bryan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, was there anything that we didn't talk about that you thought we might discuss or that you wanted to mention? Or?
Oh, I don't know. Keep in contact with four or five of us. They're all. That's just John died a couple years ago. Oh, actually, he's been dead 4 years. He's been 5 years this year. Can you believe it? I think that when we went into anesthesia school, John and I in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
and other anesthetists too, we were using ether.
Mm-hmm.
And open drop ether, inhalation ether, and cyclopropane. And when I was in anesthesia school in 1960 in at Letterman Army Medical Hospital, a new anesthetic agent came out named Halothane. And there was no vaporizer for it at the time. So what we would do is we would put it in an ether vaporizer, which was a little glass jar with a wick in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a thing at the top where you adjusted, you know, like real scientific. You open a little bit more, you get some more, whatever. The whole thing, you know.
Uh-huh.
Money is sufficient to do what you want to do. You don't have to have a PhD to do that. And, well, in those days, of course, the anesthesia machines were ventilated right into the rooms. So therefore, the people that were in the room, the surgeons, the scrub nurses, the scrub technicians, the anesthesia personnel, etc., etc., were breathing this stuff. And I remember I used to go home and my wife would say, "Oh, Barry, you used ether today," or, "You had biasing," or, "Oh, cyclopropane, oh, this mucin called halothane, huh? Well, you've been using that a lot lately." Well, eventually over the years, of course, they found out with not ventilating the anesthetic gases, there was definitely increase in spontaneous abortions of pregnant female people in the operating room.
Mm-hmm.
And so many years ago, they started, of course, ventilating all this stuff. So now when you ventilate a patient, you pop off, you know, there's a certain pressure. You don't want to give the patient any more. There's a pop-off valve, and that's sucked out through a thing. It's ventilated to the outside air.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had one friend, Marty Hampley, he was in, and he became the chief at the Health Services Command, which is also in San Antonio, right next to the academy. And he ended up having a big cyst on his liver. Well, John, I ended up having renal cell cancer. And I had a radical nephrectomy in 1988 or 89. And what's very serendipitous is how it was found. My younger daughter was getting married. And my wife and I were moving some furniture. And I ended up having a varicocele. I don't know if you know what a varicocele is. But your testicle gets enlarged, engorged with blood, venous blood.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it's on the left side, but I had mine on the right side. And I figured, I was just removing something. I probably, maybe broke a blood vessel or something. But I thought, I'll go see the urologist. I went to see the urologist, and he says, "Oh, yeah, it's probably from moving the furniture." He says, "Well, you know what I think we ought to do? I think we ought to get an ultrasound on it, because it's usually on the left side, not the right side, because the anatomy, we do understand, not being a nurse or a doctor, but the anatomy of the drainage up and back up to the abdomen." So I went and I had this little thing on my kidney. And then they did a CAT scan, and sure enough, so I had this radical nephrectomy due to renal cell CA. And I was very lucky. Mine was contained within the kidney itself. I never had metastasized. You know what metastasized is? That's when cancer spreads out.
Okay.
And you're metastasized, like to your lungs or to your brain.
Okay.
There's a primary tumor, and then there's the secondary tumor and metastases. The primary tumor I had was a kidney tumor.
Mm-hmm.
But if I metastasized more, it would have gone up to my lungs or my brain, etc. Anyhow, a year later, John,
mm-hmm.
my best friend, nursing school, best man in the wedding in anesthesia school 6 months after him, he was undergoing a physical exam. And he retired many years before, and he was down in Lubbock, Texas. And he went over to Reese Air Force Base, and they were doing an exam on him, and he didn't feel good or something, and they palpated him, and they found this big mass. Well, they did him, and they found out that he had a big renal cell CA, but his was much bigger. And they operated on him, but his had metastasized. His was in his lymph nodes.
Mm-hmm.
So it eventually, of course, it went up to his brain and all that. And he died a couple years later. And Marie, his wife, and I were talking about this and this other thing that happened to our friend Marty Hensley with his liver cyst. And we said, you know what? We're wondering if this is a result of two guys, one who smoked, me at the time, and John who did not smoke. One who drank, I did, John didn't. But what did we have in common? We went to nursing school in Philadelphia. We drank Philadelphia water. We breathed Philadelphia air. But we did go to anesthesia school, and this new halothane was coming out, and we were breathing this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, since then, halothane has been implicated in causing many other things in a human's body, but not specifically renal cell CA. So Marie and I thought, you know what we ought to do? We ought to do a follow-up on this and see, not only in the Army, but surveys somehow, all the nurse anesthetists and all the anesthesiologists we can get hold of in this whole country, and many of them had lindodontrinal cells, particularly in our age group that were learning the anesthesia when we were ventilating all this stuff and we were breathing it.
Right.
And I said, Marie will let me know, and that was, Marie never did anything about it.
Uh-huh.
This week she's on her way to Guatemala.
I wonder if somebody don't find out that it was.
Well, because I had a friend, my friend Jim, he was in Vietnam, and he was in Saigon, but he's put in for a claim now. He just went through a radical prostatectomy. You know what that is? Prostate?
Mm-hmm.
Prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm.
He had a radical prostatectomy. Well, it turns out that Agent Orange has been implicated in people over there, GIs over there, having prostatic cancer.
Uh-huh.
And he's putting in some papers now to get reimbursed or something or other than that. And he said, you know, you ought to look into that and see if there's anything I need to do, if there's something on record there.
Uh-huh.
That being in Vietnam, because John was in Vietnam too, if there was something in Vietnam, Agent Orange or something, that might have contributed to what we have. But I was never exposed to Agent Orange that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't sprayed on me, and I wasn't out in the jungles,
right.
You know, getting it. The only way I could have gotten it is if somebody came in with it on and I was breathing it in. It's the same thing with Jim. He's in Saigon, you know, down here, and, you know, they don't even know a war's going on down here, so I wouldn't know where he got it.
Mm-hmm.
He would have less chance of I getting it because I was up in the jungle parts. He was in a huge metropolitan area, and I was in the jungle, you know, where 5 or 10 miles away they were dropping this Agent Orange, and maybe it's, you know, I don't know. But anyway, it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, me. I don't know about you.
No, it is interesting in the way that the, the benefits all work out, and, you know, how to get benefits for all of these different things. Interesting. Well, good luck with that.
Down. I have my military retired pay, and I retired from the University of Michigan. I have my retired University of Michigan pay, so I can't complain. It's been a good life. Now, what would I do over if I had my life to do over? Because I really enjoyed being an anesthetist, and nursing was okay.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's skim, but, you know, taking care of people and what yak back, all this kind of stuff. It's anesthesia is really... it's just really demanding, and it's just ultra demanding.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't bond with a person, I don't think, any more than that.
Right.
Taking their life in their hand, and that. But of course, the surgeon does too, and that kind of stuff. But you know, we always say in anesthesia, when the surgeon makes a mistake, we're the ones that have to correct it. I mean, we give the vasopressor, pressure. We have to give the blood. We have to do this anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
Here at the University of Michigan, we have a very good department. Radiology, and within radiology is a specialty called interventional radiology. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Okay, well, there's several parts of radiology. There's taking your chest x-ray, and now, of course, there's taking CAT scans, and taking PET scans, and taking MRIs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And doing different things. Like I went down 2 years ago and talked to Cho, the chairman of the department, did an arteriogram on my kidney. My left my kidney is left because when I had my radical nephrectomy, they found out that I had a kink in my left renal artery, and there's a stenosis there, and so I only have 50% blood flow. So I have hypertension, so they were just checking it out to make sure that it hadn't closed down further, that I would need to have some surgery to that, and stuff like that. Well, interventional radiology, what they do is they do stuff like that, and they do other things, like they put stents in, and they dilate things. And now cardiac, they do in a cardiac lab. And a cardiologist does that, but there's a radiologist with them. When they put a stent in to your heart, into your arteries, same thing. That's interventional. It's an interventional treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's using radiology because you're using an x-ray machine and fluoroscopy to do it.
Uh-huh.
And when I went down there, I had a friend who was there. He had done his residency under Dr. Cho, and he said to me, this is about, maybe 20 years ago. He says, you know, Barry, he says, this interventional radiology is just going to go crazy. And he said, we are going to start taking over more and more of what surgeons do. Instead of you cutting you open, we're going to take little wounds and dilate things, and we're going to go ahead and stick little stents in and kind of stuff like that. And I find that very fascinating. So,
mm-hmm.
Whoever again, I might do that, but I don't know. I like the anesthesia too much.
Sounds like you picked the right field then, after all of that. Well, I really appreciate appreciate it. There's a lot of interesting things that you talk about.
You know, I think that when I graduated from high school, I think now about what's happening to one of my grandsons, that even then, maybe I wasn't mature enough and I didn't know exactly what I wanted, you know, psychiatrist yet, what it means.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed the kids today, my grandson, 17 years old, he doesn't know what to do, so he's signing up to go to the Marines for a couple years.
Mm-hmm.
I have another friend, she's a nurse, and she has a master's degree. Her husband has a PhD. He has his own lab business, you know, where he does blood work and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And their oldest kid was doing so good, and all of a sudden he started on the dope, which my grandson had done. And all this kind of stuff, he looks like he's facing, he's going to have to go to jail because he skipped whatever it was last year and that kind of stuff. And she said to me, she has so many friends that this stuff is going on. And I think that the same thing happened to me when I went to school and I didn't know what I wanted to do really.
Mm-hmm.
But in that day, there were less options. You just did something or you shaped up or something like that. I think the kids nowadays are graduating from school and I don't know if it's the change in society, the family, the school, religion, or whatever. Something's lacking. I think they're graduating more nowadays and they don't know what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. 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 Well, who knows? Glad I'm not deciding again. Let me end the interview and then I'll explain all about the forms I'm going to send you and all of that.